Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What sort of life experiences give a writer the tools to craft classic adventure stories? Nearly every aspect of Jack London's life was challenging, from his illegitimate birth to an unstable mother, to his entry into the unchecked child labor system of the late 19th century, to the irony of both deep commitment to socialism and great love of wealth. But London managed to squeeze an amazing amount of excitement and success into just 40 years of life before dying of a morphine overdose during a painful episode of kidney disease. James L. Haley is a historian, biographer, and novelist. He chronicles London's remarkable story in his new book, Wolf, The Lives of Jack London. Jim, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you for having me back on. It's great to be back on your airwaves. It's been a few years.
Well, we're glad to have you. I want to start with your title because it sets the stage for how you tell this story. What are the different lives of Jack London?
Well, you know, everybody, at least his biographers, always sort of capitalize on the adventures of his life to sort of move the story of the biography that they're writing, but they haven't really got into his head. And I was under such a length restriction in this book that this was sort of a mechanical device to divide up his lives into the different realms of experience that he had and sort of give myself a word length and say, okay, you've hit 8,000 words for this chapter. Anything else has to come out of another one. Because my editor was calling up my agent saying, we're worried about him. He does big books.
So you
don't want a big book. We want a little book.
And you could have filled 1,000 pages on Jack London.
Well, I've been awfully tempted to send some of the reviews back to the publishers because 4 or 5 of the reviews have said, gee, this book should have been longer.
Now, a difficult childhood is almost a cliche for a lot of great writers down through history, but London's wasn't just poor. His mother was an exceptionally hard person to like. Can you tell us a little bit about her?
Well, poor Flora. She was probably mentally damaged when she had a fever, probably typhus, when she was about 13 or 14. Stunted her growth. Her hair fell out. She was probably about 4 feet 8 inches tall, very brittle. She came from wealth in Ohio, born into a 17-room mansion. But she was a wild child, moved away, wandered the West. One hates to think all the things that she did. She became a spiritualist. She was a medium, and that's how she supported herself on the West Coast. And she sort of found herself in San Francisco, because San Francisco in the 70s was a very wide open place. I mean, there were covens, if you will, of free love, which was, you know, very scandalous to the polite people. So between taking her lovers in easy relationships and supporting herself with seances, oh, and piano lessons, she was well-bred. She gave piano lessons for money. She was never stable. And when he was born, he was illegitimate. Johnny was. And there's been all kinds of speculation about who his father might have been. When she married John London, the baby was 8 months old, and she was really in no hurry to reclaim him from his African-American wet nurse, Jenny Prentice. She's very, you know, almost barren of maternal instinct. And what affection he got came from what he called Mammy Jenny. She hated that because she was, even in the 1870s, 1880s, she was very proud of being African-American, which was an unusual voice for him to hear, you know, growing up. And then his stepsister, Eliza, was another source of affection. But it certainly didn't come from Flora.
Yeah, Jenny's an interesting, that relationship is very interesting because later on, there's a lot of reflection of what sounds like just abject racism in the things that London is recorded to have said.
Yes. And Jenny was quite dark. And, you know, there is that sort of internal racism among African Americans from back in those days of lighter is better. But she was a former slave. She had been through that whole Gone with the Wind thing. She had begged at the street side. And she had come to believe that black people were innately superior to white people. And she was never shy about expressing that. And there again, San Francisco, Oakland, the California West Coast, the West Coast, was one place where you could speak freely. And Flora was completely the opposite. She was so anxious to regain her her lost station that anything darker, whether it was, you know, Portuguese or Asian or certainly African American, was just inferior. So he had very mixed messages growing up. In his adulthood and in his writing, he became, I think the more accurate term would be, a racialist, which is that the other races are morally, intellectually equal of white people, but they're better off if you don't try and integrate them and marry them and so on. And the only thing that got him away from that was a sojourn in Hawaii, which at that time it was common to read even the newspapers about the Hawaiians, the Polynesians, really being sort of the equivalent of African Americans in for Jim Crow purposes. And when he got over there and found what, you know, a wonderful advanced culture Hawaiian people had, he had to rethink that in 1907. His experience in Korea in 1904 did not do that. So he went through quite an evolution of his racial thinking by having gone to the South Seas.
So, Jim, by all accounts, Jack London's stepfather, whose name he ultimately took, was a pretty decent and affectionate parent. How was it that London had to start working just amazing amounts of hours from the age he was, what, 9, 10 years old?
Yes. Well, John London was a Civil War veteran. He was disabled and on a tiny pension. He only had the use of one lung. So as hardworking as he was, he could only do a certain amount of labor. He was a farmer by profession, and his market gardens in the peninsula and around Oakland actually did very well. What ruined him time after time was Flora, who kept pushing him into one financial overextension after another, and she played the Chinese lotteries, and she would come up with all kinds of get-rich-quick schemes, which eventually Jack London's writing was one of them. When he finally got to an age that he had to go back to work, and, you know, this is after years, and that was his first life, is what he called the work beast. She was the one who eventually said, okay, we can get by on the pension. You keep writing stories. One of them will sell eventually. So there is a good outcome to Flora, at least for that period, you know. But poor John London was ruined repeatedly by caving into Flora's trying to get rich on what little they had.
Interestingly, those years that Jack London, the child, was forced to work so hard did give him a great deal of sympathy for exploited workers.
Oh, boy. Well, you know, this is the same era that Mark Twain invented the phrase the Gilded Age, and where you had him writing about it somewhat humorously, or you had Edith Wharton writing these Birds in Gilded Cage novels about, oh, do I have to wear the kid gloves or will the silk ones do? You know, well, Jack London saw this whole era from the ugly underbelly. You know, he was starching the collars for these people in steam laundries for 10 cents an hour. And what really set him off was when he came back from his sealing expedition. That's another one of his lives, was as the sealer. At 17, he was slaughtering seals in the Bering Sea. He came back, and the United States was just wallowing in the depression that started with the Panic of 1893. And the only job he could get was shoveling coal in an electric railway. See, he had read Horatio Alger. He had still to believe that you could, if you worked hard and you were honest and you were good, that you could rise in life. I mean, he was, you know, he really believed Horatio Alger. And the job that they gave him, oh, yes, you can be an electrician, but, of course, we have to start you at the bottom. Here, you shovel coal. Well, he worked 10 hours a day, usually more, because they gave him supposedly 10 hours of coal worth of coal to shovel. 30 days, he only got one day off a month, dollar a day. And then he found out after he sprained his wrists and had to wear leather splints and sprained his back and he could hardly walk and he would knot up on the streetcar going home. One of the foremen eventually felt sorry for him and told him that for this $30 a month, he was doing the same job that the coal company had just let two men go. And they were paid $40 a month.
Each.
And if God on his throne had sat down and tried to think, how could I make the angriest socialist who ever lived, he could not have done better. And that the Electric Railway Company was only one instant out of many where his labor was exploited. And when he finally just threw it all over and he became a tramp, that was another one of his lives. He just went out on the road. And he met men who had worked and wanted to work, but they had become so injured and so used up that nobody would hire them. And so life on the road was it. You know, when he went to England to write People of the Abyss, at the beginning of his literary career, he was a leader of the muckrakers, discovered that in England, at least, they had the workhouses for the indigent poor to go into, but nothing like that, even in the United States, not that the workhouses were any, you know, bed of roses. But oddly, as a socialist, he was not anti-wealth. He was only against walking over people and using people up to get the wealth. And that's one thing that we've lost that nuance today, because socialism 100 years ago was a much more altruistic, a much more idealistic concept. You know, we've had this century now to realize that it doesn't work. But back then you had very distinguished politicians, statesmen, who thought that socialism was a very good concept. Even here in Texas, I think it was the gubernatorial election of 1912 when Oscar Colquitt was reelected. The guy who finished second, Redden Andrews, was the best-known Baptist preacher in this part of the country. He was the Billy Graham of his day, and he ran on the socialist ticket.
That would not happen in 2010.
No.
Despite this, he was to the point that he would sign his letters, "Yours for the Revolution." But his socialism really didn't even raise any eyebrows until after he died.
Right, and he wound up being on a red list. You know, during the Red Scare in the 20s, dossiers were started on him. Even in the 50s, J. Edgar Hoover had a file on him because people still read his books. And that's one of the reasons why I really wanted to write Wolf, is that nobody understands that about him anymore. In our pantheon of writers and cultural heroes, we very often give them a bath before we put them up there. I mean, you have Charles Lindbergh from the right, or you have Helen Keller from the left. Well, we'll forget about their politics because they did such great things. And that's what we did with Jack London. He wrote these quintessential boys' stories like Call of the Wild or White Fang. And so they couldn't really do away with him completely. But yeah, when he would go out and give speeches, and he was a highly paid lecturer, you know, he'd stand up, you know, "Brothers, the revolution is coming," and rah, and nobody wanted to hear it. They wanted to hear about Alaska. They wanted to hear about Tahiti. And it drove him crazy. It really did. And then the socialists themselves in this country drove him crazy because they were so hung up on their doctrines that they couldn't see the real world that he had gone out there and experienced.
So they wanted him to be poor, too?
They wanted him to be poor. They wanted him to support their causes. For instance, in 1914, he went to Mexico to cover the revolution. And he was all ready to, that's another one of his lives as the war reporter. And he got down to Mexico and realized that it was not just American capitalism oppressing the poor Mexican laborers. It wasn't like that. And he wrote dispatches home about how Mexico has always been... Their chances have always been subverted by generalissimos who, you know, pretty much rape the country for their own good and pose as being for the little guy. And you don't have to look much farther than the fact that Mexico's still that way to see that he was right.
James L. Haley is with us. He's a historian, biographer, and novelist. His new book is called Wolf, The Lives of Jack London. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program. You can cultivate your intellectual curiosity and design a curriculum tailored to your personal or professional interests. And you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is James L. Haley. His new book is called Wolf, The Lives of Jack London. Join the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or call us at 1-800-933-5372. So, Jim, one of Jack London's many lives was as a prospector. Can you talk for a minute about his time in the Yukon? Because this turned out to be disastrous in one way and actually really serendipitous in another.
Well, you know, when the first ships came back to San Francisco, Seattle, with gold from the Yukon in 1897, it just sent shockwaves through the country because the unemployment was still devastating. There were so many poor people who were looking for some way to get out of this malaise that the country was in. And London, in his starving artist mode at that time, and sick of being a work beast, and all of the jobs that he could get paid 10 cents an hour, he joined that rush within, it was 11 days after the Excelsior docked in San Francisco with the news. He and his stepsister's husband were on their way to Alaska to get rich. He did not go thinking to write stories. And when they got there, and the whole thing was so crazy. I mean, there were journalists, a few of them, who pointed out that you guys realize that this is mid-July. When you get to Alaska, it's going to be winter, and you're not going to be able to do a thing but freeze. Well, that didn't register on anybody. So they get to Juneau. They get in an Eskimo canoe and hire paddlers to take them up to Skagway, and his brother-in-law was on in years and finally gave it up because he just couldn't do the walking. And it was horrible. I mean, people had very stupidly taken horses with them to do their hauling, and there was no forage. The country was horrible. And one of the pictures that I used in the book is called Dead Horse Gulch. Hmm. And Jack London adored horses. He loved horses, and this was a real slap in the face to him. But he and his partners got up over the Chilkoot Pass, which is where a lot of them gave up, because it's three-quarters of a mile upwards at 45 degrees to the Canadian border. And that's another thing people forget. The gold actually wasn't in Alaska. It was in the Canadian Yukon. You had to go through Alaska to get there. And, of course, he had taught himself to sail on San Francisco Bay as an oyster pirate, which was another one of his lives. And so his was one of the outfits that got through. They had to build boats and sail through this succession of lakes and rivers to get to the Yukon and then down the Yukon to Dawson and the gold fields. And the rivers, the terror. I mean, they would go over rapids called the Horse's Mane and things like this, and whirlpools would swallow people around them. It was just a terror to live through. And they got there, and of course, the best gold claims were taken. He got scurvy, which is called at the time was called, you know, the Klondike Plague, scurvy. And he probably would have died if it had gone on any longer. He managed to come back with gold enough, about $4.50 worth of gold. but after the thaw, he built a raft and floated the entire distance down the Yukon to the Bering Sea and then caught a steamer back home. And his sister, who had financed this whole expedition with a mortgage on her house, he had to face that poor woman and tell her he was broke. But he was going to make good on it again. And that's when he began writing, because so many things he had seen in Alaska sparked his imagination. But he did not go up there with any thought of coming back as a writer until he went up Henderson Creek, where their claim was, to do some prospecting on his own. And he was sick, he was cold, he was lonely, he was miserable, and he just had this epiphany that he would become a writer. And in fact, it was years later when they found this line shack, the dugout that he was in. He had scrawled on a log over his bunk. It said, Jack London, minor author, January 1898. And that's what he decided to do, and he was going to do it come hell or high water. But it turned out that Alaska was very good for him because it gave him the firewood for several of his books. But that's not why he went there.
And he was an exceptionally prolific writer once that's what he set his mind to.
Yeah, his goal was 1,000 words a day. There may have been a few days when he missed.
As a professional writer, tell us how common or uncommon that is.
Doing 1,000 words a day is easy. Doing 1,000 publishable words a day is not so easy. And even for him, because he was the first one to admit that a lot of his work, whether it was for Hearst newspapers doing puff pieces about social events or some of his stories and novels, really were not very good. And even he called them hack work. But when the inspiration was on him, and I think Call of the Wild was the first time he ever actually sat down and the muse took over. Here's your story. Here's your characters. And he was taking dictation from the ether. And having written a few novels, and I'm sure the novelists who are, are listening to us right now knows that that is a magical moment when you know that you've got it. It doesn't happen for all of us. But, yeah, 1,000 words a day was his thing. And he may have missed a few days, but he was very prolific. He did about 50 books before he died when he was 40.
And a lot of people aren't aware, and you've alluded to this several times, he had a really robust journalistic career.
He did. In fact, the very first time he went abroad, he had written a piece, I think it was for Overland Monthly, about the impossibility of future war and how stupid it was to have war, because now you have machine guns. And so these frontal assaults will just mow people down, and you'll have these bloody stalemates. And of course, this is 15 years before World War I. He writes this about the stupidity of trench warfare. Well, he got a commission at the end of the Boer War in South Africa to go interview the generals down there. So he had a ticket to sail to London, then sail to South Africa to do this. But the war was over, and the generals were already gone. So that's when he made the connection with George Brett, an American publisher, founder of U.S. Macmillan, which was a distinguished old Scottish house of what they call Christian reform. And he said, well, as long as you've got your ticket, and I wanted to publish you anyway, why don't you go write about the homeless people in the East End of London? Because Brett had just published Jacob Riis's book on the slums in New York. So to have a book on the slums in London would be a good companion. And so, yeah, that was the beginning of his journalistic career. And he covered the Jack Johnson bouts for this newspaper and that one. In fact, when he built his yacht, the Snark, to go to the South Seas, he tried to put together stringer contracts for a number of different magazines who actually got annoyed with him because they thought they were each getting an exclusive.
Now,
but as all of we freelancers know, you know, you try and kill as many birds with the stone of each story as you can.
And as time went on, he would earn great amounts of money and lose great amounts of money and spend great amounts of money. There never seemed to be quite enough to be comfortable.
Well, you know, when he came back from Korea and Hearst paid him off for that 4 months over there, he had money for the first and only time. His first wife, Bess, that was a very interesting marriage. They didn't love each other, but they had decided that being such good platonic friends would make a good home for children and so on.
Yeah, you say the only thing they had in common was that they liked to ride bicycles.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And they made two daughters, Becky and Joan, very quickly. But Jack London was a full-blooded sexual creature, and Bess was a Victorian prude. He loved to socialize. She wanted seclusion. It was just awful. So when he came back from Korea, he was met with a bill of divorcement, as they say, and she got all of his money. And then, plus, he was still supporting his mother. Shrew that she was, he supported his mother all his life. And when his wet nurse, Jenny Prentice, who was also getting on in years, when she needed help, he supported her. And then there were the various tramps and hobos that he'd been out on the road with who would come by for a handout. And it got to the point, even though after Call of the Wild, he was the highest paid writer in America, parentheses, although he never made any money off Call of the Wild. George Brett did not think that this would sell very well, so he gave him a $2,000 lump sum, which was good.
Yeah.
But there was no royalty agreement. And if Jack London had had a royalty agreement for Call of the Wild, he never would have had all those years of poverty. But, yeah, he was the highest-paid writer in America, and he never had a dime. He acquired a ranch in Glen Ellen, north of the Bay Area, that he poured his heart, soul, and most of his money into, the Beauty Ranch, which is now the Jack London State Park. That was a sinkhole of his fortune. Building the Snark, which was his yacht that took them to the South Seas, Because eventually, you know, he ran out of Alaska ideas and needed some new source of inspiration. That was a huge pile of money. He wanted to build a big hunting lodge kind of house on the ranch, what his best friend George Sterling called the Wolf House. That cost a fortune, and then it burnt down the night it was finished. And since there was no mortgage on it, he didn't have insurance, and that was lost. But, yeah, for all his life, paying the monthly bills was what he referred to as Jack's monthly miracle.
Tell us about George Sterling, because they had a very close relationship. It sounds, from reading your book, like it may very well have also been a sexual relationship.
We don't know. In fact, it's very interesting. London wrote a good deal about homosexuality. It's this natural thing. It happens in jail, and he'd spent a month in jail in Buffalo. It happens at sea, and he'd been on the Sophia Sterling. It happens, you know, wherever men are cooped up together, like he was with his partners in Alaska. But, of course, I never did this. But, you know, he would, he had copies of Havelock Ellis's sexuality books annotated. Josiah Flint, who was a hobo out there on the road, wrote a book about being a hobo, saying a very modern estimate that he figured about 10% of the hobos were homosexual. And there was once in Manhattan when he was doing a pub crawl with a local publisher, and the gathering point for the homosexuals at that era was at the Flatiron Building. And as homosexuality was understood at that time, they were, you know, in makeup and standing around being very fey and very feminine. And that's the way it was understood. George Sterling was 8 years older than London. He was sort of a minor poet, although he was very gifted in California. And when London became suddenly famous, Sterling was one of the leaders of what they call the crowd in San Francisco, this bohemian gaggle of artists, writers, painters, poets, anyone with artistic pretensions. And it's entirely possible that London took to calling him the Greek because he was really a beautiful man. You don't see that from his pictures. There are very few pictures of George Sterling. He didn't photograph well, but there's very few pictures of him where you see what a magnificently handsome man he was. And then London, I think, was always, the people that he picked for his best friends were always a few years older than him so that he could not just buddy with them, but they could mentor him as well. He missed that. And when he was engaged to Charmian Kittredge, he wrote her a letter saying that this had kind of come between him and all the women that he dated before, that his great desire in life was to have an ultimate male companion that he could love and be with forever and all this. Well, you can imagine writing this to your fiancé that would not have gone down well with many. And so it's entirely possible because they read their poetry together. They went on long hikes together. But I don't think that you could say that either one of them was like a repressed homosexual. I think he was just an entirely sexual being. And if there was some emotional or even sexual exploration on their part, they never wrote about it. But it's been part of the whole canon of Jack London biography from day one, and you would have like Charmian saying, "Oh well, he was far too morally superior a being to ever do this," and he was, you know, in his own handwriting, it's right there that's what he wanted. So, you know, his ex-wife and his wife and a couple of his biographers have made sort of cottage industries out of deflecting any possibility that he was ever anything but, you know, Jack London, you know, hairy-chested beast. And I thought, well, I'm not going to be the first one to write about this, but let's just go ahead and explore it, and maybe I'll be the last one to have to write about it.
Well, and he does seem to have adored his second wife, Charmian Kittredge. That was a love marriage.
Oh, very much so, because she was the only woman I think he'd ever met that he could neither con her nor dominate her. She was massively intelligent. She was a concert pianist. She was an expert horsewoman, multifaceted gifts. She was a crack editor as well, and when she met him, she was not all that impressed with this, you know, published his first short story, kind of, his clothes don't match, I'm not sure about this fellow. But as their chemistry sort of had its chance to work the first time that they had a chance to be alone, he spent most of the time telling her what he didn't like about her, and then he kissed her.
Sounds like a movie. You know, that I love that scene because it sounds like something you'd see in a movie.
Well, I don't know what. There's been a couple of Jack London movies, but I suspect that any film rights are probably tied up in his estate or something, or we would have seen movies about him and Charmian by now, because it was the poor man was incapable of fidelity. I mean, he cheated on every partner that he ever had. You know, he was a terrible husband and a worse father, which, by the way, you might get the idea that I was determined not to let London capture me. when I wrote this book, I was, you know, I had to keep some distance from him, although as a writer, you know, I felt a lot of empathy for him.
Well, talk about the challenges, Jim, of someone who has been written about so much over the years, of going back through similar sources of information and finding new insights.
Well, it was funny because everybody, well, at least over 30, probably had to read Jack London when they were in school. They had to read Call of the Wild or White Fang or
Seventh
To Build
English,
a Fire
right.
or something like this. Well, for some reason, I went all through school, and I never had to read a syllable of Jack London. So when I had done a book with Simon & Schuster's Free Press, which is a big one-volume Texas history, which is the last time I was on KERA in Dallas, which I sold a lot of books, by the way. Thank you very much. We thought about, well, you know, maybe a biography, because my Sam Houston biography won a bunch of awards. And my editor, Bruce Nichols, we talked about maybe doing Steinbeck. Well, Steinbeck hasn't been done in a while. And I was talking about Jack London with a friend of mine over wine on my front porch. And I said, yeah, the poor man, he's the highest paid writer in America, and you never had a dime, and nobody understood that. It was a Homer Simpson moment, you know. Don't! You know, Jack London is the one I need to do. But I had the advantage of doing this, that I got to read his writing from the very first efforts all the way through his career and see how he grew without any preconceived notions of what I'd read in school.
James L. Haley is with us. He's a historian, biographer, and novelist. His new book is called Wolf, The Lives of Jack London. We'll resume our conversation in a moment. If you'd like to ask a question, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program. You can cultivate your intellectual curiosity and design a curriculum tailored to your personal or professional interests. And you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is historian, novelist, and biographer James L. Haley. His new book is called Wolf, The Lives of Jack London. If you'd like to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. So, Jim, when A Call of the Wild came out and the book started coming out, was he instantly famous?
Like a skyrocket. Mm-hmm. He was, it happened very quickly. Actually, Chris, I'm sorry I'm so wordy. I wanted to go back and give a better answer to the question you asked about finding the new information about him.
Sure.
Which is that writers, including me, tend to be lazy. And, in fact, one of my favorite writers, Will Cuppy, who wrote a wonderful little series of biographies in the 30s called The Decline and Fall of Practically Everybody, made fun of historians in there who always just repeat each other. And he gives the example of Lady Godiva and how she was the sister of Thorold the Sheriff, and there he cites about 9 different sources that she's the sister of Thorold the Sheriff. And then in his own little footnote, he says, this would mean more if we knew who the hell is he. You know, and so all these biographies about Jack London, for instance, when he's 8 years old, he's riding on the potato wagon with his father, and they see this torn book at the side of the road. They stop and pick it up because they can't afford books. And it's a novel called Signa by an English writer who went under the pen name of Ouida. She's best known for Dog of Flanders and a couple of other books. But anyway, Ouida, the last 40 pages are missing. And in his own memoirs and everybody that writes about him, Ouida, her Cigna, was the basis of his literary career. It was his inspiration. He got into Cigna, and that's what fired him to become a writer. And nobody, not one of these books, apparently ever cracked the thing to see what it was in there that would fire the imagination of an 8-year-old.
Hmm.
And so when you start reading the thing, and it's not hard to find, it's right there online, all you have to do is download it, and you read it, and to take just a second, he was only a little lad coming, singing through the summer weather, singing as the birds do in the thickets, as the crickets do in the wheat, and you read a couple of pages of this, and you think, my God, that's Jack London. The alliteration and the use of color and even the phraseology. Here he is, 8 years old, and he just dots like a lump of marble for him to start chiseling on the style in this book. And I thought, what kind of intelligence, what kind of prescience is there in an 8-year-old to read an adult-type novel and use that as his energy ball to fashion his career out of? So it's not like I found more details about his life, but there were many, many places where, forgive me, lazy writers like me just didn't look very hard.
So it's a matter of getting outside of the echo chamber.
Yes, and a matter of, forgive me, what in legal circles they call penumbral research. You don't just research him, you research around him.
Yeah.
You know, like when he went to England to write People of the Abyss, only two of the biographies even mentioned that he crossed on the Majestic. But I thought, wait a minute, here's a guy who taught himself to sail. He was a sealer and an oyster pirate. What kind of reaction would he have had to the largest and fastest ship in the world? And so you read what the letters that he wrote from on board the Majestic, and you see that not only is he, you know, enthralled by just the engineering marvel, but the socialist in him was absolutely repelled by, you know, the Atlantic liners, the whole Titanic thing. Of, you know, they would have the first class staterooms for the rich people. That's how they made their reputations. But the bills were paid with third class steerage full of immigrants who were coming over here to be abused and exploited.
And where was London's room?
He, funny you should mention, when his bills were paid, he went first class. He did. In fact, when he was on the Siberia going to Korea, he even wrote jokingly about that back home about, yeah, the accommodations are really pretty good. He was a massive contradiction. He was.
Did he like being famous?
He did. He did. He had always felt abused and unappreciated when he was young. And in his stacks of correspondence, I mean, just the mailbox was full every day. He would get up early in the morning, and he would answer all these letters, whether he knew the people or not, whether he could help them or not. But he answered all those letters, and he would never even receive company before noon.
Hmm. Talk for a minute. I mean, it makes sense that given the very adventuresome life he had early in his life, that he had a lot of injuries over time. But at what point did it start to be apparent that his health was failing overall?
When he was on the Snark sailing the South Seas, he came down with some tropical diseases that really laid him low. For one thing, he discovered surfing. In fact, Mark Twain had written about surfing, saying that, you know, these people are crazy. Look what they're doing. London actually tried surfing and got some locals to teach him how to do it. And his writing about surfing is at an ecstasy that he never achieved in anything else. And he was out there on the water surfing all day long, and he got burnt to toast. He got all kinds of skin maladies from the South Seas, and not just skin, but he was very, very sick by the time they got to Australia, and he had to come home. Between that and the alcoholism and the failing kidneys, his diet was awful. His big thing in his diet was he loved raw duck. Maybe it was an Alaska thing.
Raw pressed duck. I don't even know what that is.
Yes, and he, I've asked, and I can't find, you know, I couldn't find anybody to tell me, but it would be cooked for like 5 minutes, I assume, to just release juices. When he was pub crawling in San Francisco, he would eat cannibal sandwiches, which were raw beef between bread. But it was terrible for his kidneys. So he had uremia. He had the skin problems. He had all kinds of bowel problems. And at the end, he was also being treated with salvarsan, which was an arsenic treatment for venereal disease. And so there's been speculation whether the morphine overdose was suicide. And in fact, the first classic biography of Jack London by Irving Stone, called Sailor on Horseback, just gets right up to saying that he killed himself. But that doesn't make sense, because if he was going to kill himself, he would have just taken all that he had. You know, he wouldn't have measured out this maximum dose. You know, what can I take and go to sleep and still wake up? Because he was in terrible pain at the end.
Was he depressed?
His major clinical depression was before he married Charmian. Mm-hmm. In fact, he would call it his great sickness. He would be situationally depressed, either by his mother or his bad first marriage, or the stupidity of the literary public, who, you know, they wanted his adventure stories, but they wouldn't read his social commentary. Although Brett did very well publishing his social commentary. I would make some distinction between, you know, a real, deep, long-lasting depression, which he got over when after life with Charmian began, and just the situational anger and frustration, because he was always in and out of that.
And it is sort of a horrible scene when they discover him unconscious. He sticks around alive for a day or so, just sort of fading in and out. For a while, they had him standing up, and it looked like he might be okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, he had just won a lawsuit with some neighbors who sued him for damming a creek on his ranch. And Charmian, to try and wake him up, yelled at him that the dam had broken. And they would walk him around the room. But I don't know. I think by then, you know, he had quit the Socialist Party by then, not because he had lost his fire for revolution, but because they had. You know, the progressive era has sort of sucked some of the wind out of those socialist sails. And he was very annoyed that his work wasn't being as accepted as it was. He and George Sterling had a falling out over one of his late novels, The Little Lady of the Big House, which the literary commentary on it is that it wasn't that good. And in fact, George told him that it was not that good and made him very, very angry. He got spoiled, both as a writer and as a public figure. He had a valet that he made call him master. And he just got to the point where he thought everything that he wrote was brilliant, and it wasn't. So I think, I'm not sure how hard that he would have wanted to come back. I think he was done.
Mm-hmm. Which is incredibly, I mean, he packed a lot of living into 40 years. But
it's
incredibly sad to think about this just very vital person coming to that end.
And there were so few people, and that to me was the great tragedy of his life. There were so few people who could really comprehend a soul as complicated as his. So there was really nobody to embrace and understand him.
Talk about your experience, Jim, in reading all of London's works that you read as an adult. Do you think we have unfairly buttonholed him as a writer for, you know, adolescent
boys?
Oh,
my goodness. I mean, some of his novels, like The Star Rover, which has to do with astral projection, or he wrote another novel that was based on atavism and ancient race memory. He was very cutting edge. It's a shame that he is only remembered for his youth stories. Oh, it's funny, when I was at a Christmas party a couple of years ago, and Steve Harrigan was asking me, well, how are you doing with the Jack London thing? Have you started it yet? And there was a magazine editor standing nearby who stood in to this conversation and didn't start talking about To Build a Fire, but he started reciting To Build a Fire. I thought, oh, Lord, I'm in over my head. Yeah, a writer this well-known. It was a really wonderful adventure to discover what all he could do. In fact, there's a poem that he wrote called To George Sterling that we couldn't get permission to publish because it's still tied up in the estate, that shows a poetic side of him. He was a brilliantly sensitive poet, and nobody to this good day knows that, because it's not in my book, because we couldn't get permission to do it.
Can you recite
a bit
of it for us?
Yeah, he was a multifaceted, brilliant artist.
Do you have any of it committed to memory that you could recite some?
Probably not without getting sued.
All right, we won't press you on that.
Oh, good.
We'll go to the phones now, 800-933-5372. We'll speak to Marvin in Fort Worth. Hello, Marvin.
Hi, My question is, I was wondering, after reading Call of the Wild, in fact, I taught it in a combined history literature class, and I had the impression that his writing was heavily influenced by the thought of Herbert Spencer, of social Darwinism. Is that the author's impression?
Boy, you hit the nail right on the head. He had annotated copies of Herbert Spencer in his own library. He was fascinated by social Darwinism. In fact, he once got into quite a big argument with Mary Austin, the Southwest author, who was sort of dismissive of him, that he was just then discovering. See, the thing about Jack London is he was an autodidact. He left school in eighth grade, eventually went to high school but dropped out, passed entrance exams, was a semester in Berkeley, but almost everything he knew about culture and science, he taught himself. And, of course, he did have a wonderful friend, the librarian Ina Coolbrith, who ran the Oakland Library, who coached him. And he had other literary coaches, and what do you need to write? But you're absolutely right. Herbert Spencer was big on his list.
How interesting a read is John Barleycorn, which was his memoir of dealing with alcoholism?
The more I read it, the more surprised I was that it is his autobiography. It is his autobiography, and his frankness about it and his honesty about it is such that you almost see the beginnings of Alcoholics Anonymous in it.
Did it feel modern in that respect?
It did. Mm-hmm. It did. In fact, he's one of the most, in his word usage, and as, the more I read of Jack London, I mean, like I said, I started this book knowing that it needed to be done, but I hadn't actually read Jack London. And I thought, well, God, what am I going to do if I get into this? You know, I've got a contract and I've got to write this book. What if he, kind of like O. Henry, wasn't really that good, you know? But that was not not an issue. I mean, the man was just a protean writer.
So did you read, you didn't read all 50 novels, did you?
Oh, no. Some of them are not worth reading, frankly.
Which, for people who read White Fang and Call of the Wild, give us a rundown of two or three others that we really ought to pick up.
That you really ought to pick up? Oh, boy. I would say for his social commentary, War of the Classes, which I think is still in print with some people. I'm just looking at my own list here. When God Laughs has got some really nice stories in it. Before Adam, which is his atavistic novel. Oh, that's a humdinger. That came out only the year after White Fang. We talk about Call of the Wild and White Fang. Of course, his other really big success was The Seawolf.
Oh, sure.
Which was the first feature motion picture made in the United States, made into movies many times since then. And it is completely the opposite. This is American naturalism at its birth. You know, Jack London led. He did not follow Upton Sinclair and Dos Passos, and that he had so many literary stepchildren. But those are the books that I would latch on to.
James L. Haley's new book is called Wolf, The Lives of Jack London. Jim, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, Chris, this has been so much fun. I can't wait to write another book, and maybe you'll let me come back.
Sounds good. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.